Hi again. Welcome back to the Scandinavian History Podcast with me, Michael Schenkman. Last time, we focused on the Northern Seven Years' War, which devastated large parts of Denmark and Sweden, causing suffering and death to an untold number of civilians and to a surprisingly large number of Danish admirals. In that episode, I mentioned briefly that King Erik XIV of Sweden had a bit of a breakdown in 1567. But I didn't go into any detail. I only pointed out that his cousin, Frederick II, did what he could to exploit the crisis in the Swedish national leadership to try and turn the fortunes of the war. This time, though, we'll dive deeper into the mental state of the King of Sweden and talk about the grim consequences of this extraordinary royal meltdown. Episode 80, Murder Madness. As we covered last time, the war against Denmark had been going poorly. King Erik of Sweden had already caved under pressure at Halmstad, where he left the army when his plan to take the town failed. Things hadn't improved since, and the king was suffering from the immense stress of running a kingdom and fighting a losing battle against his Danish cousin. At the best of times, King Erik was suspicious by nature, borderline paranoid even. When he ascended to the throne, he established a network of spies that was to collect intelligence abroad and keep track of Erik's untrustworthy subjects at home. The king also established a special court called the High Commission, or the King's Commission. The leading force behind the High Commission was a man called Göran Persson. Officially, he was the prosecutor, but since he was also the guy who appointed the judges, he controlled the work of the commission and could more or less decide its rulings at will. Göran Persson was the son of a priest and he'd been sent to Wittenberg to study. After his return to Sweden, he found work in the royal bureaucracy and toward the end of Gustav Vasa's reign, he'd been tasked with drawing up a list of estates that had belonged to the church and that the king thought should become crown property. This was an important job, and it indicates that young Göran was held in high esteem in the royal chancery, despite his relatively humble background, or maybe thanks to it. Göran Persson's next job was to be secretary to the heir to the throne, Erik, and when Gustav Vasa died in 1560, that meant that Göran found himself at the very epicenter of power as the trusted advisor of the new king. Erik XIV trusted his secretary blindly and showered him with favors and gifts, including an estate and a noble title. This in itself would probably have been enough to put a target on the secretary's back, but through his actions, he'd attract even more animosity from people at court and beyond. Göran Persson's most important role within the royal bureaucracy was no doubt as the prosecutor of the High Commission. Some have even claimed that the court was Göran's own idea to begin with, but that can't be established for certain. What we do know is that according to an instruction dated November 1, 1563, the High Commission was to serve as a higher court, ruling in cases where local courts throughout the kingdom couldn't reach a verdict. The rulings passed by the High Commission were to be treated as if they were passed by the king himself. But soon this role of Court of Appeals became secondary. Instead, the High Commission's primary function was to try people accused of various crimes against the crown. There were usually 9 judges presiding, but sometimes more. When the friends and associates of the king's brother John were put on trial, there were no fewer than 24 judges participating. But the number of people behind the judges' table didn't really matter in the end. Since they were all hand-picked by the prosecutor, Göran Persson, the rulings were usually a foregone conclusion, and the proceedings tended to be swift, even summary. More often than not, the accused met with the same fate as the men tried for their connection to the king's brother John. That is, death. After John himself had been arrested and brought to Sweden from Finland, it was Göran Persson who met him as the representative of the king. He delivered a speech full of accusations against the duke before sending him off to his prison at Gripsholm Castle. He'd visit the imprisoned prince and his wife from time to time to make sure that all the strict instructions of isolation were kept up. Beside trying John's courtiers, the High Commission also handled the cases against the members of the military leadership who King Erik accused of causing the repeated failures in the ongoing war against Denmark. In addition, a number of governors and other noblemen were also tried for various real and imagined crimes. Needless to say, the High Commission was not popular in the leading circles in Sweden. The kingdom's nobility saw it as a dangerous and unpredictable weapon that could be directed basically at any one of them at any time. To make matters worse, it was run by that parvenu Göran Persson. This also influenced how the Swedish nobility saw the king, who let himself be guided, maybe even controlled by this low-born man. Not that King Erik really cared what some aristocrats thought about his trusted advisor. As I've already mentioned, Erik XIV didn't trust the Swedish nobility. And that wasn't only because he was suspicious, bordering on paranoid. Remember that the Swedish nobility had turned on his father Gustav Vasa on more than one occasion. At one point during the Westrogothian Thunder, they had even appointed a man from their own ranks who was supposed to take over as king once Gustav Vasa had been toppled. If you don't remember what we talked about in episode 75, you can be sure that Erik remembered, keenly. There was one family in particular that the king was wary of, and that was the Sture family. That wasn't necessarily because they were behaving suspiciously or in any other way had given the king any reason not to trust them. No, the problem was different and more delicate. The Sture family had held leading positions in Sweden since the 14th century. As you may recall, members of the Sture family had even ruled Sweden during the last decades of the Kalmar Union, and they arguably had a better claim to the crown than the Vasa family did. When Gustav Vasa had tried to agitate for his rebellion against Christian II, he had stressed that he belonged to the Sture party, because people knew and loved the Stures, whereas Gustav Vasa himself had been an unknown nobleman at the time. Even though Gustav Vasa had used his proximity to the Sture family in order to convince people to back his claim to the throne, once he was on it, the Stures became a problem for the Vasas, for the very reason that they'd been useful before. The Sture family had tons of tradition and legitimacy, whereas the Vasas were new. We've talked about the Vasa family's status as newcomers on the international stage, but it played a part also domestically. Gustav Vasa was suspicious of the Stures and their supporters. He feared that they saw him as a usurper and that they perhaps wanted to replace him. Erik XIV, who was even more suspicious than his father, shared his distrust of the illustrious Stures. When Erik became king, Svante Stensson Sture was the head of the Sture family. He was the son of Sten Sture Jr. and Kristina Gyllenstierna. As you may remember from the episodes about the last years of the Kalmar Union, he had died trying to fight off a Danish invasion, and she had defended Stockholm against Christian II. But whatever Erik may have thought about Svante Sture in private, in public he played the game, even granting Svante the title of Count early in his reign. With that, Erik gave the impression that he now felt that his dynasty was so secure on the Swedish throne that the former ruling family no longer was a threat or a concern to him. Or maybe he was just trying to keep his enemies close. The newly minted Count Svante had a son, Erik Sture, who happened to be in service to John, the king's brother. When the relation between King Erik and John deteriorated, this connection threatened to involve the Stures in the Vasa family feud. Svante warned his son to leave John and return to Sweden, and he did so just in time before John and his wife were arrested and many of their courtiers sentenced to death by the High Commission. Svante Sture had an older son as well, Nils Sture. He held a senior position at court. He and the king were even close, and the king seemed to trust him. He trusted him so much that he participated in one of the delegations sent to England to convince Queen Elizabeth to marry King Erik. As you know, that didn't go particularly well, and the failure to secure Elizabeth's consent put a dent in Erik's trust in Nils Sture. But during the war with Denmark, Nils was still given an important role in the army command. He was a commander at the disastrous battle on October 20th, 1565, where some 5,000 Swedish soldiers fell. His younger brother Erik Sture had also been present as the royal standard bearer, a highly prestigious, albeit militarily insignificant, task. When Erik Sture realized that the battle was lost and that it was time to flee the battlefield, he was desperate for the royal standard not to fall into enemy hands, so he ripped it off the pole and smuggled it with him in the most inconspicuous place he could think of at the time, in his pants. Erik Sture's quick thinking did save the royal standard from falling into Danish hands, but the king nonetheless did not appreciate having his personal standard shoved down some guy's pants, even if it was the pants of one of the most senior noblemen in the realm. For his failure to win the battle, the High Commission sentenced Nils Sture to death for treason. He was pardoned, but he was then forced to undergo the humiliating entry into Stockholm that we talked about in the last episode. Sitting on a starving horse, he was led through a triumphal arch of upside-down trees. Then he was handed a crown of hay instead of laurels, and he was handed that blank paper of non-existent lands and gifts. This parody of a triumph granted successful commanders was designed by Göran Persson, but of course King Erik had approved it. Nils Sture was a proud man, and even though he hadn't been sentenced to death after all, this display was nothing short of social death. This treatment wasn't just humiliating, it also undermined his political clout and was designed to weaken his and his family's prestige. If he didn't already, then this degrading ritual surely made Nils Sture distrust the king, maybe even hate him. And many other members of the nobility had the same reaction of horror, since they thought that the king had acted unfairly and punished Nils Sture too harshly. And, they thought, if the king was prepared to do that to a member of the Sture family, then none of them were safe from his capricious wrath. They all drew similar conclusions about Göran Persson and the High Commission. The court was busy trying not only military commanders, but also governors and other members of the royal administration. A clear pattern emerged from the court proceedings. The High Commission was quick to mete out severe punishments, often the death sentence, and if you ended up in front of the panel of judges on the High Commission, a conviction was more or less always your fate. Unless, of course, you were a friend of the prosecutor, Göran Persson. Then the court would be lenient and you may even be acquitted. Within elite circles in Sweden, resentment against the king and his secretary and trusted advisor was simmering. People at the top were on their guard, and they did not forget. One who did seem to forget, though, was King Erik himself, because shortly after his public humiliation in Stockholm, Nils Sture was appointed ambassador and sent to lead a diplomatic mission to the region of Lorraine in order to propose marriage between the king and some new potential blue-blooded bride. This appointment must have surprised the young nobleman, but he accepted and set off to try and woo some German princess on behalf of King Erik. But both the king and Nils Sture himself would soon have reason to regret that he ever took the job. In early 1567, one of King Erik's many spies reported a rumor that there was a conspiracy to sabotage the king's attempts to marry this princess from Lorraine, or any other foreign princess for that matter. Instead, according to this rumor, the high nobility were conspiring to force the king to marry some Swedish nobleman's daughter, which would further strengthen the power and influence of the nobility at the expense of the crown. If Erik would refuse to marry a local girl, the nobility would start a rebellion against him. The report was quite detailed, and it contained a list of names, including that of Svante Sture, the father of the man King Erik had just put in charge of the mission to Lorraine. The report seemed credible to the king, who was already suspicious of the intentions of the nobility, and later in the spring, the plot thickened further. In May, the king's spies reported that the diplomatic mission led by Nils Sture was planning to disembark in Kalmar and start a rebellion there, aiming at toppling Erik. The king acted immediately. He sent instructions to Kalmar forbidding troops from entering the city, and he also sent invitations summoning the noblemen who had been named as members of the plot to come and see him at Svartrö Castle west of Stockholm, where he was staying at the time. They weren't told why the king wanted to see them. Erik Sture, the man who'd smuggled the royal standard away from the losing battle stuffed down his pants, was the first of the summoned noblemen to show up. He arrived at Svartrö Castle on May 8th and was immediately arrested. So were all the other invited noblemen as they made their way to Svartrö throughout the month of May. They were all interrogated to make them confess their crimes, but no confessions of high treason and a planned rebellion were forthcoming. Only after two of the imprisoned noblemen, Abraham Steinbock and Ivar Ivarsson, were tortured, they eventually confessed, as people so often do when they want torture to end. Servants of the aristocratic suspects were also questioned, and one of them was pressured into saying that Count Svante Sture's secretary had more information. Soon thereafter, Svante Sture himself arrived at Svartrö Castle in the company of Sten Leijonhufvud, younger brother of Gustav Vasa's second wife, Margaret. That made him the uncle of Erik's brothers, John and Karl. But Erik's relationship with his brother John was somewhat strained at the moment on account of the king having arrested John for treason and holding him prisoner at another castle in the area, so I'm not sure the family connection was an advantage at the moment. And sure enough, both Svante Sture and Sten Leijonhufvud were arrested and tried by the High Commission. True to form, the judges wanted to sentence the accused to death, but the king hesitated. After all, this was a bunch of senior noblemen, some of the most influential men in the realm. He wanted the Riksdag to decide their fate, perhaps also because he wanted a public trial. So when King Erik and his court moved to Uppsala for the upcoming meeting of the estates of the Riksdag, the prisoners and their families were brought along. The High Commission stayed behind at Svartsjö to interrogate the servants of the accused to obtain more evidence. Traveling in those days could be exhausting. The roads were horrible, narrow, bumpy, and dirty. It also took a long time to get anywhere because you couldn't travel faster than your feet or your horse could move you on those poor roads. This was true for everyone, even the king. And on this particular journey to Uppsala, something seems to have gone wrong. Maybe there was some logistical issue, maybe the road was too poor for the royal carriage to pass. We don't know exactly what happened, but we do know that King Erik had to cover the last few kilometers of his trip to Uppsala on foot. And the status-obsessed and thin-skinned monarch complained bitterly in his diary about the indignity of having to walk, or as he put it, having been abandoned on the road and having to enter Uppsala on foot like a commoner. So the king was in a foul mood when he reached the city. When he arrived, he was even further annoyed because he thought the welcoming committee wasn't impressive enough. Only the archbishop and a handful of noblemen. The city wasn't decked out to greet its king, and the streets weren't teeming with people waiting to catch a glimpse of him. This too irked the king, who felt ignored and slighted. All four estates had come to Uppsala. Clerics, noblemen, burghers, and peasants. But the group of noblemen in attendance was unusually small, only 20 people. Many had chosen to stay away, perhaps out of fear or in protest against the king's treatment of the prisoners from Svartsjö Castle. But no fewer than 600 peasants had shown up. They weren't overly bothered by the conflict between the king and the aristocracy, and besides, they all got half a barrel of salt each from the king for showing up. Needless to say, the peasant estate was in the king's pocket, ready to vote in favor of whatever he'd suggest. This was Erik's usual MD. He called the Riksdag almost every year, and he'd always pit the three other estates against the nobility to get his way. The bribe, sorry, gift of salt was a clear indication that this was the king's game plan also this time. On the evening before the Riksdag was to start its deliberations, the king hosted a feast. It was a lively affair with a lot of booze, and everyone had a good time. Perhaps a little too good a time, because when King Erik showed up at the opening of the Riksdag the following morning, he was seriously hungover, and predictably in a bad mood. Hardly in top condition to deliver his important opening speech to the gathered estates. Worse still, he had somehow lost his notes for this important speech. Erik was furious and blamed his aides, suspecting them to sabotaging his appearance on purpose. Maybe, the paranoid monarch thought, they were agents of his enemies and had hidden his speech so he wouldn't be able to offer a coherent case against the prisoners from Svartsjö. Well, he wasn't going to let them stop him, and instead the hungover, angry king stood up and improvised a speech. Always a good idea, if you ask me. Erik soon started to lash out against Nils Sture, whom he had sent off to find a royal bride in Lorraine. The king railed against him and his co-conspirators. The speech was probably just as incoherent and unsettling as you'd expect, and it was even met with scattered protests from the audience. That's not something that usually happens when the king spoke, and Erik felt attacked and never finished his speech. Instead, he left in a huff and let his right-hand man, Göran Persson, continue and try to convince the estates that the accused were guilty. The following day, the proceedings continued without the king. Witnesses, mostly servants, were heard who claimed there was indeed a conspiracy against the king. A handful of nobles had supposedly joined together to oust Erik XIV because they wanted revenge for the king's shameful treatment of Nils Sture. Erik Sture's hiding the royal standard in his pants was now not seen as a desperate attempt at saving the king's banner, but a sign of the nobleman's disrespect for the king, whose symbol he had defiled by shoving it down his pants. Whether it was the testimonies or the gift of salt that did the trick, we don't know, but in the end the accused were convicted and sentenced to death, just as the king had wanted. At this point, Nils Sture had been away from Sweden for 10 months. As far as he knew, he was the king's trusted ambassador, sent on an important diplomatic mission to Lorraine. But on the evening of May 21st, the very same day the death sentences against the accused noblemen were handed down, Nils Sture was coming home. With impeccable timing, he rode into Uppsala to report back to the king on the very same day that his family's fate had been sealed. He didn't know his brother and father had been sentenced to death, and that the king had railed against him to the estates in the opening session of the Riksdag. Unsuspecting, Nils Sture went to see the king, but he wasn't granted an audience. Instead, the no doubt surprised and confused nobleman was arrested. On the following day, May 22nd, the king sent a letter to Count Svante Sture, who was imprisoned under harsh conditions. Apparently, he was only allowed one bottle of wine per day and only two dishes per meal, so you can imagine his suffering. Anyway, considering what had transpired over the last few weeks, the letter was surprisingly cordial, and the king asked him to relate all he knew about the conspiracy. In his response, Svante Sture insisted that all the accused were innocent, and that it was Göran Persson who was the king's real enemy, giving him bad advice and poisoning his mind against the nobility. 2 days later, early in the morning of May 24th, the door to Svante Sture's cell suddenly swung open and a surprise guest walked in. It was the king himself who'd come to see the head of the Sture family. Svante Sture had not expected a visitor at that hour, least of all the king. In fact, the prisoner was still only wearing his nightshirt. But then came an even bigger surprise. King Erik fell to his knees and apologized for his humiliating treatment of the count's son Nils. He also promised Svante he'd soon be free. Then Göran Persson appeared in the doorway and called the king away. Still, cheered by the surprising development, the count started to get dressed hurriedly to be ready for his imminent release. At the same time, his wife, Martha, was called to the king's mistress, Karin Månsdotter, who assured that Martha's husband and sons would soon be set free and no harm would come to them, despite the death sentence from the Riksdag. After his visit to Svante Sture's cell, the king went for a walk together with the Bishop of Kalmar. But after his chat with the bishop, Erik returned to the castle and marched straight to Nils Sture, whom he hadn't seen in 10 months. The king barged in and greeted him with the words, "So here you are, traitor." In response, Nils supposedly knelt and protested that he was innocent. Then King Erik suddenly whipped out a dagger and stabbed Nils Sture in the arm. According to what we're told, Nils calmly removed the dagger, kissed it, and handed it back to the king. If the gesture was meant to soften the king's resolve, it didn't work. Erik stabbed again, and again, and again. And then again some. Nils Sture's clothes from this day has been kept, and the blood-soaked shirt sports a large number of holes from a sharp object, like a knife. After the murder of Nils Sture, the king left the castle again, this time accompanied by his guards. His old teacher, the elderly council member Dionysius Bureus, followed the king, likely to appeal to his better judgment and to calm him down. But when he reached King Erik, he hardly had time to open his mouth. The king ordered his guards to cut the old man down, which they did. Then the king left Uppsala in a hurry. The body of Dionysius Bureus was left where he had died. We don't know for certain what Erik was up to during this time, but the king had clearly lost it completely and wandered through the countryside for days. In the king's absence, his closest associates were left to try and interpret his will and kill the rest of the noble prisoners. Despite the king's promise from earlier that day not to execute Svante Sture, he was the first on the guard's death list. One of the count's loyal servants was present when the executioners arrived. The guards wanted the servant to leave, but he refused, even though they beat him. In the end, they let him stay, so we have an eyewitness account of what happened. When Svante Sture understood why the guards had come, he protested that the king had promised to pardon him. But the guards ignored his claim, saying they had orders to kill him. And then they started to stab. After several wounds, the count was still alive and crawled onto his bed. Then finally someone managed to cut his throat. After the deed was done, the guards locked the door and left the body in the cell for over a week. Then nothing much happened for the rest of the day. In the evening, though, guards pushed into Abraham Steinbock's cell. He resisted, but was eventually killed as well. To avoid any similar drama, Erik Sture and Ivar Ivarsson were told that they were only being moved to better accommodations. Instead, they were brought into a cellar where they could be dispatched more discreetly. Erik Sture suffered no fewer than 47 stab wounds. Ivar Ivarsson also received several. By this point, there were two surviving prisoners, and the reason for that was that the guards had a bit of a dilemma. The commander of the guards had asked the king if all the prisoners were to be killed, and the king had answered, all except Stein. Unfortunately, there were two prisoners called Stein, and the commander never got around to ask for a clarification. So to be on the safe side and not kill the wrong guy, both Stein Leonhuvud and Stein Banir were spared. But even though the killings were finished, the king was still gone. So the guards kept the castle locked up and the murders a secret. This meant that for days, Martha Sture, who had been promised by the king's mistress, Karin Monsdotter, that her husband and sons would be pardoned, believed Svante, Nils, and Erik were still alive and well, so she kept sending food and clean clothes to the castle. In the end, it was King Erik's stepmom, Dowager Queen Catherine, sister of the murdered Abraham Steinbock, niece by marriage to Count Sture and cousin to Nils and Erik Sture, who insisted that the gates to the castle be opened and she be let in to see the prisoners. She was the first person who hadn't been involved in the murders who found out what had happened. And it was she who brought the news to her aunt, Martha Sture. It took 4 days before the king was finally found. He was hiding in a priest's home in a village outside Uppsala. He was confused, wearing peasant clothing, and convinced Nils Sture was now ruling the kingdom, even though he had personally perforated him repeatedly only a few days before. King Erik was brought to Uppsala, but he was in no state to rule. Back in the 16th century, they not only lacked proper roads, but also any deeper understanding of mental health issues. In court circles, it was assumed that the king had been possessed by the devil, or that his confusion was a divine punishment for the murders of the Stures and their associates. During the time that King Erik was out of commission due to his mental state, the Council of the Realm took over the ruling of the country as best they could. When they were in charge, they took the opportunity to release the king's brother, John, from prison at Gripsholm Castle. The council, whose members all belonged to the uppermost crust of the high nobility, also took advantage of the king's confusion and made him agree to a batch of new privileges for the nobility, including no more duty to contribute to the war effort. That particular decision was particularly poorly timed, and as we talked about in the last episode, the Danes exploited the chaos in Sweden to go on the offensive in the ongoing Northern Seven Years' War. The council also sent out letters trying to explain what had happened in Uppsala on May 24th. They did their best to downplay the event, claiming the deaths had all been accidental, but also blaming the whole affair on Göran Persson. The widowed Martha Sture was given lands and a large sum of money in compensation for the deaths of her husband and two sons. The council also took the chance to put the hated Göran Persson on trial. He was placed before his own high commission, and the judges, as always acutely aware of political trends, sentenced him to death. But in the meantime, he was only locked up, because no one had the guts to execute him. They all feared that the king would come out of his insanity and punish the people who ordered the execution of his most trusted advisor. It took some time for the king to recover, though. Only in August did he start writing in his diary again. But interestingly, there's a note from July 6th stating, "Had Chef Christopher beheaded." But that's most likely a forgery, added later in order to undermine King Erik's reputation and to make him out to have been even crazier and more unpredictable than he actually was. We can be pretty sure Erik never made that notation for two reasons. The king was ultra-sensitive to status and rank, and lowly kitchen staff would never have been granted the honor of a beheading. A chef would just have been hanged. Secondly, the notation is made in poor Latin, and whatever flaws Erik had, his Latin skills were excellent. Anyway, in the fall, the king moved back to Svartsjö Castle, but he was still not completely well. He continued to suffer from nightmares and episodes of confusion. For instance, on October 9th, he met with his brother John, and at that meeting, Erik was under the impression that John was the king and he himself was imprisoned. John tried to calm his brother, but with limited success. Only in December, King Eric was well enough to take back the reins. But as soon as he was back in control, he dropped a bombshell that would send shockwaves through his court and the country as a whole. He announced that on July 13th, he had married his lowborn mistress, Karin Mon's daughter, in a secret ceremony performed by the archbishop. Now Karin, his sister's former maid, was officially introduced to the stunned court as his wife and their new queen. She was also visibly pregnant. This announcement not only stunned everyone who heard it, it would also have momentous consequences for Eric's own reign and life. We'll talk more about that next time. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Scandinavian History Podcast. If you did, why not spread the word wherever you congregate with others who are also into Scandinavian history? Also, please consider leaving a stellar review, or at least 5 stars, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, where you can rate podcasts nowadays. This is an excellent way to attract new listeners and to support the show. Another good way to support the show is to purchase some Scandinavian history-themed merch in the Scandinavian History Podcast webshop. I especially recommend something from the Odin's Lifehack collection. It's a line of merch with quotes from Hávamál, accredited to the King of the Gods. You can get t-shirts, mugs, tote bags, and many other items with nuggets of Scandinavian wisdom, such as, "Wake up early if you want another man's land or life," "Only fools hope to live forever by avoiding enemies," or "Speak useful words or be silent." Links to these amazing products and more can be found on the Scandinavian History Podcast Facebook page. If you haven't already, then please go to facebook.com/Scandinavian History Podcast. Like and follow the page if you want to shop or if you just crave more content, at least vaguely related to Scandinavian history. Via the Facebook page, you can also send me questions or angry messages about things I've said or not said on the show. If you prefer Twitter, or X as it's apparently called these days, then you can follow me and send me messages at Schenkman. That's S-H-A-I-N-K-M-A-N. I look forward to hearing from you.